Hi, everyone, and welcome to Behind the Numbers. My name is Dave Bookbinder, and if you are just joining us, welcome to the program where we dig deeper to understand what really matters most in business. Today, I've got a really special guest. I'm proud to call him a friend. He's a colleague. He's a collaborator. He is a three-time CEO. He's a workplace behavior expert. He's an award-winning business coach. He's also a rock star, which we may or may not cover today. I'm talking about Dave Nast. Dave, welcome to Behind the Numbers.
Welcome. Well, geez, thanks, Dave. Good to see you.
It's good to be visible. Thanks for joining us today. folks out there watching and listening who are fans of the program may know the name Dave Nast. This is not your first rodeo on Behind the Numbers. But for the folks who haven't heard the name Dave Nast before, why don't you tell folks who you are?
Let's see. I'm a business coach. I'm a Vistage chair. And I also run a company called Nast Partners, which are certified partners for the Predictive Index. I'm a recovering headhunter. Did that for 17 years. And that's kind of who I am, I guess. And a recovering musician as well. Were you going to cover that?
A little bit low key here, Dave. I need you to raise your energy just a little bit for the audience before we lose them. Okay.
Gotcha.
I know you can bring it. So I didn't want to mention in my intro of you that you are a Vistage chair because I thought we were going to actually be talking about that. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to use those words. So since you did, thanks for that. Tell people what Vistage is and what does it mean to be a chair of Vistage?
Very cool. Yeah. So Vistage is probably the original CEO peer advisory group, started 67 years ago. CEO peer advisory, when you think about that, get a bunch of CEOs together from non-competing industries in a geography to share knowledge, help one another, bring different perspectives. Non-competing industries is important because, you know, people will go deep. They'll share their balance sheet, talk about trade secrets, all that stuff. Confidentiality is part and parcel of everything that we do. The Vistage membership application is 3 pages long. Page one is a confidentiality agreement. As the chair, I facilitate the meetings. We do have speakers in those meetings a lot of times. Other times we're doing what's called issue processing. Vistage has this method they developed years ago to help people get to pay dirt. My job is to facilitate that, make sure we're going in the right direction, make sure we're getting to pay dirt for everybody, and also not getting too off track. I usually have some insight into what the issue is because I have one-to-ones with the members between the meetings. That's where we do some of the coaching. And they also have access to the community at large. Vistage has 45,000 CEOs in 35 countries. I have a long history with Vistage. I've been, a member. I've been a speaker. I worked at headquarters. That's where I met my wife. That was a happy accident. And now finally a chair. I wanted to be a chair 12 years ago. They talked me into recruiting chair. So I recruited CEOs to become chairs. And I guess I should say that chairs are peers. So to become a chair, you've been a CEO, you've, you know, been in their seat before. That also helps bring some perspective as well.
Yeah, you've got an amazing toolbox. And I say that completely objectively because I've worked with you professionally and you bring so much to the table perspective wise, having been a CEO several times. You've got the been there, done that credibility. And you're a great facilitator. And I wanted to just explore here for our audience. Because you're exposed to leaders in that trusted environment, you know, obviously without divulging any confidentiality matters here, but want to try to unpack and uncover, are there recurring themes that you see that the Vistage CEO members are grappling with?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of common themes across all these different businesses. Like I have three groups, and in the groups, we've got manufacturers, professional services, we have retail business, we have medical device companies, all kinds of things. And what they all have in common is people. And that's general in business and as far as how it goes, but also all business problems are people problems when it comes down to it. So I'm seeing that theme over and over again. And really, here we are, you know, post-pandemic or whatever, it's still right person, right seat is still a problem. When I say that, I have one member who's in the logistics industry. He has all the right people in all the right seats. You know, he's protecting his margins. They're a market leader. They've been hit with some things regulatory wise in the last couple of years, but they've had to shift on the fly. And for a really large organization, they cut on a dime because they've got the right people. So that ability to adapt has really been key for them. You know, go back to Darwinism. It's not about who's the biggest or the strongest. It's who can adapt. That's true in business. That's enabled them to stay number one in their segment because of that. But it's because they have the right people. I think their turnover is like 7%. It's ridiculously low. And then by contrast, I have other members in other industries where 50% turnover is normal. And you're kind of like a college basketball coach at that point, right? The seniors leave, we're getting the freshmen in, it's a whole new team, and they're having to deal with that. That is fine if that's the nature of the beast, but it becomes harder to adapt when you're constantly dealing with new people. Systems and processes can help a little bit there, but really getting the right people in the right seats is still key to adjusting to everything that's changing right now. AI is everywhere and everyone's talking about it. And I've heard some speakers talk about, you know, just some good strategies for it, which is cool. But there are some businesses that are being remade by AI. My old industry, executive search, for example, I saw a pilot, if you will, of an AI program that can write the job description, go online, solicit candidates, do the first round interview with them, gather their information. And if it's hooked up to your applicant tracking system, may even be able to present the client to the candidate. That's going to make some folks obsolete at some point. In my opinion, it's not there yet. It's not good enough, but there's early adopters who are going to plug information into it. And you know how AI works. You put info into it and it just gets better, gets better, gets better. Yeah. So it's a matter of time. And if you don't have the right people in the right seats, it's going to be really hard to adjust to that, I think. And by the way, I should mention that whole thing with executive search tends to be the lower level jobs, the senior C-level jobs, still a lot of human interaction there.
Yeah. Let's go a little bit deeper into the right people, right seat thing, because part of that is leadership, right? It's first of all, identifying the right people for the team. But when you think about, as you mentioned, adaptability, flexibility, how do you get the right people in the right seat?
Yeah, you know, it's a culture thing. It starts with culture and what you're looking to do. But really, you know, I'm a big workforce assessments guy, analytics, things like that. We use the predictive index, which is really cool for that. But the one thing I love about PI is when you're putting together a job target, and I'm not just talking about PI, I'm talking about the rationale behind this process. When you're putting together a job target, you know, let's say we're hiring a CFO. I'm making this up. Well, what are the five positions that touch that job every day? Let's have them take an assessment for what success looks like in the role. It's called the job assessment. The output of that's going to be an aggregate score for like a job target. But let's look at where everybody fell, those stakeholders, because if they're not in alignment, good luck. You'll hire someone and they'll leave in a year because, you know, they're being stretched in all these different directions and that's not helpful. So we get everybody aligned first. I'll actually run what's called a reconciliation conversation. And gee, Steve, why do you think this person needs to be so independent? Steve makes a point the other ones hadn't considered. And then they're like, oh yeah, that's a good point. So we narrow in the focus on all these aspects of this role. Well, once we have that solidified, now let's go find what we find. PI is going to measure the behavioral drives and the cognitive abilities of someone. So you're talking about right person, because every job's different. What's required to be a nuclear safety regulation officer at a power plant is a little bit different than being a pharmaceutical salesperson who lives out of their car. So those are going to not just be different personalities. It's not a personality test. It's how they're driven. Hopefully the nuclear safety regulation guy is risk adverse. That'd be good for all of us.
Yeah.
But the guy who's living out of his car, that person's got to be really comfortable with risk. So that's very, very different. And those are extreme examples. But if you can nail that down, that's great. Because here's the key. If I know what drives someone's behavior and I have a baseline for where I want someone to be and I understand where they fall, well, I can help people stretch and adapt and close that gap in a way that's comfortable and satisfying. It's never about perfect fits, by the way. I think I've, last count, I think I've done 22,000 job targets and I think I've seen 12 perfect fits in that time. It's just not going to happen. So it's not about that. And PI is not about labeling you and saying, oh, this is all you'll ever be. It's more about getting understanding of the baseline of what drives your behavior so that I can measure you up against where I need you to be, look for fits and gaps. And now because I know what drives your behavior, I can coach those gaps effectively. So And this is all about the selection process, getting people in the door. Now, PI will also give you really good comprehensive interview questions to ask of that person in a role if there's gaps here and there, so you can ascertain it. They're usually tell me about a time when questions. They beg a story, so you can learn if someone did it, how they think, how they solve problems. That's cool. That's all about selection. Well, now the person's in your lap. What do you do? So there's a coaching guide, there's onboarding guides, things like that to get somebody oriented. Onboarding is a lost art. When I say that, it's because people make their, I forget the statistic, it's something like 60% of people make up their mind in the first 90 days whether or not they're going to stay here for a long time. Wow. If things go really well, it won't enter their mind to leave. But if things don't go well, it's like, better than not working, I'll just keep looking. And, you know, we've all had that happen. And we talk about engagement as well. And the analogy, Dave, that you've used more than once is, you know, if engagement's around 30%, I think it's dropped into the 20s. But if they're around 30%, you've got 10 people on a lifeboat. The three who are engaged are paddling, trying to get to shore. You've got four sitting in the middle, just kind of going, it's kind of cold out here. We know those employees. And then you've got three who are actively disengaged. And disengaged means they're poking holes in the boat as water rushes in.
That sounds very familiar.
It does. I think we've talked about this. So PI helps with that too, because if I am doing a job that is a natural fit for me, I have brain space for discretionary effort. Well, shoot, that's engaged, right? Like I can come back and go, hey, I know we're doing it this way, but I think we can do it better. Have we ever tried this, this, and this? That's going to happen. But if I'm in a job that's causing me to stretch a lot, we all stretch to be successful. It's not a bad thing. But if I'm stretching a lot, I'm burning battery throughout the day. That's the job where at 5 o'clock, you're freaking exhausted. You're just like, oh, I got to go home. There's no room for discretionary effort there. You're just trying to get through the day. So if we can set people up for success, look for those closer matches, that's going to help everybody involved. And that's not to say that, you know, like I said, 12 perfect matches out of 22,000, you're going to have gaps. And you can also have a large gap if somebody's aware of it. I think it was a study in the Harvard Business Review where the number one thing required for leadership was self-awareness. What was frightening was that 85% of people think they're self-aware. Mm. And it was like 15% actually are. So there's 70% of people out there going, I'm self-aware, and they really aren't. It was a big assessment they did. It was like 5,500 people or something in this Harvard Business Review study. So I talk about self-awareness because, for instance, I am not detail-oriented. I'm just not. Can I do detail-oriented work? Yes. I schedule it. And when I schedule it, I know myself well enough to shut down Outlook because an email will pop up and I'll go squirrel and I'll get all distracted. I shut my door. And when it's scheduled on here, like I know that I block that time off because I write articles for stuff online. I write fiction novels. I do all this other stuff. That's very detail oriented work. I've got to concentrate. But because I know that I'm not detail oriented and that's not my natural drive, I can channel that and harness it for periods of time. Could I live in spreadsheets 40 hours a week, maybe for 2 weeks? Would I make mistakes? You bet. So
yeah, not exactly inspiring. got it. For sure. And what you just described there in terms of identifying the right people, getting them to stretch and getting the discretionary effort. I mean, that's the holy grail, right? That's you get the engaged workforce. They're more productive, more productivity leads to greater profitability. And the greater profitability, all things equal, is going to lead to a greater business valuation, which is my lens and my conversation that I'm having day to day. So it's all connected. And speaking of all connected, when you talk about the shift, the perceived shift coming out of the great resignation, where it was perceived that the employees had the power, where now post-pandemic, the employers are feeling like they've recovered the power or need to recover that power. There's a lot of talk about return to office. And I've had a lot of guests on this program. I work with a lot of clients and we have this conversation because I'm always curious to know what's going on with that. But what do you see, Dave, and what's your take on the whole work return to office phenomenon?
You know, it's not a sweeping answer. It's actually going to be somewhat situational. When it was an employee's market, you had to accommodate them. And people got to work from home on a regular basis during the pandemic. Some of them found that they liked it. And for, I think, most people, productivity actually went up. So that was a good thing. Then there's the ones that are just goofing off and they're doing stuff with their kids and they're sitting on their back porch, you know, listening to the birds, and they're not getting their work done. So I heard this recently that the measure, you know, we don't have to install cameras in people's houses and spy on them. That would be bad. I just spoke to a lawyer this morning who agrees. Not about that. Just we were talking about life and all sorts of different things in the workplace. But it's one of those things where the measurement should be productivity. We're all adults, right? If you're in the workforce, even if you're 18, you're legally an adult. So if you're getting the work done, that should be good enough. There are a lot of consulting firms out there, and I might get hate mail on this one, but they live and die by utilization rate.
Oh.
And if the work is getting done, who cares?
Yeah.
If the client is happy, your employee is engaged and happy, everything's firing on all cylinders, who cares? That seems to be the push that I'm hearing from the CEOs that I work with all the different members that I have in my Vistage groups. Most of them are still doing some kind of hybrid thing, unless it's, you know, they have to be there. Like in manufacturing, I got to be there to, you know, turn the knob on the button and all that right. sort of stuff. But that's a different environment. But a lot of them have gone hybrid and they've stayed that way. Also depends on your function. The finance team, they can do a lot of stuff from home if they've got a good secure, you know, setup on the computer and everything else like that. Sales team, you know, depends on what you're selling, but a lot of times you got to be there. Other times you don't. As a recruiter, when I had my search firm for 7 years, we all worked remote and we all worked from home. I was ahead of the curve. That was 2000. It was also cheaper. But so we did things like that on purpose. So depending on the role and the function, that's why I say it's situational. Yeah. I would say go with what's working. And your only measurement should be productivity. That yeah. really should be it. And
I'm right there with you. And I've been yeah. in those environments, you know, the leaders, they're management by spreadsheet, and utilization statistics was all that ever mattered. And that certainly wasn't an inspired place to be. And you don't get the discretionary effort for sure. But what I'm hearing, my personal belief is that the return to office thing is going to be damning for those companies that are adamant about getting people back full time. Yeah. I think productivity is the key thing. We're all adults. Anybody who's not getting their stuff done, that's a different situation. But I also understand that there's a balance here, and the hybrid thing makes a whole lot of sense, because to actually have a good culture, it's a little important that people actually are getting together and yeah. collaborating in a centralized location, i.e. the office, right? So flexibility is key, but I think the mandated return, just because you have office space and yeah. you feel compelled to use it, is messed up. The other thing that I've heard that I think is really messed up, this is an extreme example, but it's happening a lot, is the hybrid scenarios where they're requiring people to be in the office, call it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Maybe it's a staggered thing. Like you may be required to come in on Tuesday. I may be required to come in on Wednesday. And we're not there the same day to collaborate. So what's the point?
Yeah, it's almost like, well, we cut down our space and sublease this out. So we've only got like 14 desks and there's 30 of you. So you can't all be in on the same day. It's like, well, maybe right. this team is in on this day, and maybe that yeah. team, you know, it's a sensible approach, Dave, like what you're saying. It's, you know, a mix is nice. If productivity is there, people are happy, you do come together, you know, if you're a culture that has meetings that matter, meetings with agendas, meetings with a desired end in mind, those are good meetings. If those meetings can be emails, stop doing it. Some meetings yeah. can be done on Zoom. I think a lot of people are zoomed out, by the way. I've been talking to a lot of folks and they're just like, if I got to be in front of someone, I got to be paying attention. Where if I'm on the phone, I can be doing some other things. I don't have to do all. So they feel like they're at attention all the time. So there's the thing now where people are kind of zoomed out a little bit, but, I think some meetings matter if they're well planned and if they're well, you know, organized, that can be good. But meetings for the sake of meetings, that's going to kill a culture anyways. But yeah, and with the utilization rate thing, I would ask, what was the purpose behind it when you set it up? probably that the clients are getting value, and that as the employer who's paying a wage, I'm getting what I need out of my people. Well, what does that relate to? I think it relates to productivity and profitability. If those two things are happening, who cares? It shouldn't matter in that regard. And I know that's going to take 40 years of work away from a lot of consulting firms going, well, it shouldn't do that anymore. But
yeah,
really, if it's a good culture and things are going well, I would always ask, I ask this of every policy, by the way, why was that instituted to begin with? And if the rationale can be supported elsewhere, great. If it can't, well, then it makes sense. Keep doing it for whatever it is. Because there's a lot of policies in place that are good and necessary, and they're there for a real reason. There are other ones that are like, oh, that was 1970. So maybe we should change it.
Yeah, we're not going to change the consulting world and how they they measure like people's productivity in this conversation for sure.
Responses to being there going, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so. It's definitely a little bit antiquated, but look, it is what it is. I get it. But there are other things besides the numbers. You have to go behind the numbers. How's that for a cheap pop for the program?
I heard that somewhere.
But yeah, that actually does matter. And you know, look, the utilization thing, it's for somebody to get a handle on people's productivity. You know, if you're not charging your time to a particular project, well, then what were you doing? Which opens a whole other can of worms, because I remember being in situations where things like discretionary effort, which you couldn't bill to a job code, you were disincentivized from doing it, because if it didn't give you positive utilization impact, why would you do it? Anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole any further. But what I do want to talk to you about is inspiring teams. So former CEO, you work with CEOs, we talk about culture and leadership and so forth. And one of the roles of a leader, not even necessarily a CEO, but you could be just a line manager for a group of people. Maybe you've got one person and it's a matter of getting them to do their thing, but feeling good about themselves and doing it. You're not trying to like wring a washcloth and get things out of people. So how do you inspire people?
I think if you go back to right person, right seat, I'll beat that drum some more. If you know the values of someone and what it is that they're looking for, and this goes, you know, to every individual working for you, if you understand what drives them and motivates them and what they value, if you can relate the end goal to that, you'll get a lot out of them. And that can be, it'll just happen naturally. Now, sometimes that's not going to happen. Sometimes you've got somebody who's got the technical expertise, but they think very differently from everybody else. So I'm a big believer in the platinum rule versus the golden rule. The golden rule, do unto others as you want done to you. Good advice as a human being, horrible advice for a manager. The platinum rule, do unto others as they need done to them. So if you understand what drives them.
Say that again slowly so everybody lets that sink in.
Yeah, the platinum rule, do unto others as they need done to them. And if you, with the predictive index, for example, if I know what drives someone's behavior, I could have three people working for me who are very different. I need to engage them the way they need to be engaged, whether I'm delegating work, giving them a review, whatever it could be, I know how they need to be engaged. So the example I'll use is myself. When I worked at Vistage headquarters way back when, 12 years ago, I had a boss who was absolutely awesome. Now, he had my PI. I didn't know at the moment that he was playing me like a fiddle in a good way, but he got the best performance out of me. Like I crushed it there. I increased production by 640%. It was ridiculous, but it's because of how my boss engaged with me. I was a remote employee, which he'd never had. So he really took this stuff seriously and he looked at it. So one of my higher drives is about perception and recognition and things like that. So now I mentioned no detail orientation. Shouldn't say no, very little. I was in a recruiting role there. So my record keeping, I'll say it, sucked. Nah. And I came back from a vacation one day and we were having our one-to-one. And he's like, you know, Dave, your job involves 20 things. In 18 of them, you're number one. If you could get your arms around these two, you'd be unstoppable. And I'm like, oh, I want to be unstoppable. What are you talking about? And he's like, well, your record keeping, you know, really needs some work. And I said, can you give me an example? And he's like, yeah, you were away last week. I had to cover something for you. And I went in to look at the record and said, LVM 916. What does that mean? I'm like, left voicemail, September 16th. You didn't get that? He's like, no, I didn't get that. I'm like, oh, okay. how can I improve? He's like, you know what? One of your colleagues over here, she's really good at it. Just sit with her for half an hour, see what she does. You don't ever have to be as good as she is at it, but give you nice tips. The whole key to the story is I'm self-motivated to fix the problem because of the way he engaged with me. And I went about it with a good attitude of, I want to be the best. He knew how to engage with me. He knew I'm competitive. He knew what I cared about, those types of things. He knew all that stuff. If he had come to me because of my highest drive and said, yeah, I need to talk to you. These two things, dude, you got to fix that. Now, I'm somebody who communicates verbally and often. So I think everybody else does too, even though I know logically that's not true, but I think everyone else does too. So now I'm in this downward spiral going, what else am I terrible at? Maybe this isn't the job for me.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm fixing it out of panic, where the way he engaged me with it, there's 20 things about your job and 18, you're number one. If you could get your arms around these two, not fix it, you'd be unstoppable. That's the carrot dangling. You'd be unstoppable. Well, now I'm self-motivated to fix, where the other one, I'm almost demotivated and or questioning myself. So how we engage with people really matters. So inspiring someone, Todd, his name is Todd. He inspired me every week with stuff. We had one-to-ones every week for a half an hour. He always inspired me. He always got the best out of me because I left those conversations pumped. Because he knew, and he had people on our team that were very different, and they were pumped too. So I'd have to ask him what he was doing. But we have somebody who works for us, for instance, very individualized, like does things their way, the whole bit. So when I delegate work to her, if I give her four non-negotiables, that's a box. That's very confining for her. There's no elbow room there. If I give her two non-negotiables, those are guardrails to keep her on the road. So the non-negotiables usually are, I need it done by this time. How, when, where, not concerned. I'm here if you have questions. She loves that, being delegated to that way. She will come to me with questions if she has them. But if I told her it has to be this way, got to do it this way, it must be done by this time, all these things, she might shut down. And she's been working with us part-time for, I don't know, 5 years. So, that's, you know, knowing what drives someone's behavior keeps them inspired, which is really, really helpful. But also when someone's down, treating them like a human. Not everyone's going to show up every day, you know, sunshine and rainbows and stuff like that. So knowing how to engage with someone, when someone's down, if you ignore it, going, I hope that goes away, that may work with some personalities, believe it or not. But with other people, they might need a little engagement. Hey, is everything all right? Treat them like a human. You might get a human back, which could be really good. Part of my job as a Vistage chair is really to eliminate the what now to get to the what if, which is really good. And so sometimes people come to you and they're crestfallen. Oh man, this initiative, we did it and the product launch was terrible and we spent so much money on it. Our ROI, we thought it'd be 3 months, now it's like 9. Da, 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 da. You know, the right set of questions, 70% of the time, the answer is in someone's head. So I start asking what and how questions. They're investigative, they're open-ended. I don't have the answer, they do, but I got to help them get there. Sometimes during the question asking, I'll start to see like, oh, I see where we're going here, but I have to keep asking questions. They've got to come up with it on their own. Same thing with managers. When you're working with someone, if I come to you, Dave, and you're my manager, and I'm like, Dave, this broke, what do I do? And you're like, go here, do that. I'm now dependent on you. I'm going to come to you for every little thing. And then when you're not there, I'm going to sit on my heels and just, I can't do anything because Dave's not around. Nothing's going to get done. Now, that sounds silly, but one of my Vistage members, that's what goes on in their organization. It's a second generation family business, and the previous generation told people what to do. So nobody now, after 30 years of that, no one has any initiative anymore. The new guy's in, he's got ideas and he wants proactivity and go, go, go. And people are like, you didn't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
So the way to engage people with that is I come to you and I say, Dave, this broke. What do I do? And you turn to me and this is going to take you 40 seconds longer, which is what most CEOs won't invest the time in, by the way, to go, what do you think we should do? Well, I think maybe we should do this. Now, if I'm a complete moron, you can go, how about this instead? I'm still going to feel like we talked about it and I was part of the solution. I will take ownership of what comes out of that conversation and go do it. I've also learned something. So I don't need to come back to you next time that happens. But if I come up with a good idea, you're going to go like, yeah, run with that. I'll come to you less and less. If you think about it, if 70% of the time the answer is in my head, I'll come to you 70% less. And I'll feel like I'm being developed. I've learned so much from my boss because you asked me questions rather than giving me answers. So being equipped with a good set of questions can really make a difference for people. That is inspiring because now I'm just getting you into the rubber stamp stuff. Hey, this thing shut down last time we did this. I thought if we did this, we could also add this. And you're going to go, you're on it. It's a rubber stamp. But now I feel like I have ownership. I have agency. Like, this is good. All those things. So that's another way to inspire people. And same thing, like I was talking about when someone comes to work and they're down with something else that's going on in their life or a customer chewed them out or whatever it is. I lead with questions as opposed to statements. Statements at those moments can come out like platitudes. Chin up. Oh, there's other fish in the sea. You'll find another client. That doesn't help. I worked in the outplacement industry for 5 years. You just lost your job for the only job you've ever known. And someone sits across from you, you go, there's a light at the end of the tunnel and it's not a train. That's not helpful. What I used to do when I sat with those people, instead of telling them what to do and what to look forward to and blah, 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 read scripts and talk about features and benefits of their outplacement program, I asked them questions. What and how questions. That's the thing too. If I ask you a what and how question, you can't answer it with one word. You've got to talk. If you talk and I listen, the greatest gift you can ever give another human being is to make them feel heard. Ask questions and shut up. Let them talk. Listen to them, make them feel heard. That will inspire people. You can get a great performance out of someone who just lost their biggest client if you handle that conversation in the right way. And the right way to do it is to ask questions. Don't make statements. Statements can come out judgy. And when asking questions, for God's sakes, never ask a why question because that begs judgment because now I have to defend my position when I get asked a why question. And if you ask when and where, their directive, what and how, open-ended. I'm going to have to answer you with a paragraph rather than a word. And that's what you want because that's when I'm solving the problems in my own way.
Yeah. Let them talk. Let them be heard. I love listening to you talk, and I would love to continue this conversation, but we're out of time, and so much more I wanted to cover with you here today, Dave. But you've shared so much wisdom with us. Any chance I could persuade you to come back some other time?
Oh, I'd love that. 100%.
Okay, cool. That'd be great. In the meantime, for anybody out there in the audience who wants to learn more about Dave Nast, how they can work with you, how they can maybe tap into all that wisdom, a little bit more about Vistage. If they want to find out about the whole rock star thing I alluded to earlier, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Probably my email or my website. The website is nastpartners.com. Nast is NAST, kind of like nasty without the Y, nastpartners.com. And my email, very similar, dave@nastpartners.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I think I'm listed as David B. Nast there. We'll talk about what the B stands for later, but David B. Nast on LinkedIn too. There's some stuff there. I've written maybe 100 or so articles there too, but if that's helpful, thank you.
Yeah, the guy's a prolific writer. More on that some other time too. I'll drop all that in the show notes too to make it convenient. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today on Behind the Numbers.
Thank you, Dave. This has been great.
It's been a lot of fun. And thank you out there for supporting this program and listening to the show. Really can't do it without you. So thank you so much for being a part of this. My name is Dave Bookbinder, and I'm known as a business valuation expert. So if you're a business owner and you don't know the value of your business, we should probably have a conversation, and you can find me on LinkedIn. That's all we have for today, gang. We'll see you next time on Behind the Numbers. Take care, everybody.